Hello and good day, and welcome to this episode of Blood Club, where we talk about blood club. Today, I have a guest, Dr. Sarah Rutherford from Cornell University, and this is kind of a two-segment talk. I think last time with Dr. Herrera, we spoke about SWOG 1826, so that upfront Hodgkin's lymphoma randomized trial, BV-AVD versus NEBO-AVD. We really went through the history of that trial. And one of the things that I think we spent a lot of time talking about was pediatric accruals into that. And really, that brought a lot of diversity into this randomized trial. But what came out of Echelon 1, you know, was this over 60 population and whether or not we should be using BV-AVD or even BV-containing regimens in general. And what excited me was to see, Sarah, your oral presentation at ASH 2023 in the beautiful city of San Diego around kind of that population. So I really appreciate you coming today. And maybe can you talk to me about how this part of the study kind of came about, understanding that there was some hesitancy from Echelon 1 in this population?
Matt, thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to talk about this study. I think it's already changing the care. I actually had a patient yesterday who finished his last dose of nivolumab AVD. He's 71, fairly frail at the beginning, but with good cardiac function. And I'm sure that he wouldn't have been able to make it through six cycles of BV-AVD, but he got through six cycles of NAVD. There were discussions initially whether the older group should be included on this study. And I think, you know, we decided to essentially leave it to physicians enrolling patients without having an upper age limit on the study. And so there are actually about 100 out of 1,000, roughly, so a little bit less than that, but roughly about 10% of the patients on the SWOG S1826 study were 60 and older. And the results were really dramatic in the older patients with nivolumab AVD compared to BV-AVD. So not only was the nivolumab AVD much better tolerated as we expected, but the progression-free survival at 1 year was essentially a 30% difference between nivolumab versus the BV regimen, with the event-free survival being statistically significant. I think that this nivolumab AVD regimen is really becoming the standard of care already for patients who are 60 and older in particular.
So why the age 60? Because I know in your presentation, you kind of broke it up to 60 to 70 and 70 and older. And I think there were a couple of 80. In your mind, what is that inflection point of when Hodgkin's lymphoma kind of in a more advanced age individual becomes a different disease, you know, potentially than a person who's in their teens or even in their 20s?
Right. I think it's a difficult question to answer. And as you know, we're not very good as physicians at figuring out who can tolerate the more aggressive therapy. There are a lot of different geriatric type assessments. And I'm actually working with Andy Evans and some others on some initiatives to try to figure out a better way to assess older patients with Hodgkin lymphoma specifically. But I think in this case, we didn't leave a cutoff. Like I said, we know that, you know, there could be a patient who's 60 who has actually a worse performance status with someone who's 70. So it's like the age is just sort of a part of this factor.
With regards to Hodgkin's lymphoma, you know, we kind of get educated on that the older individuals were tending to do worse, you know, kind of even in the ABVD, you know, era. Do you think that it's something biologic about the disease, or is it just the age of the individual makes the regimen a little bit more difficult? Because I really don't think that, you know, ABVD is that difficult of a regimen. You add BV in it, it goes to the next steps, right? Like, is vinblastine really adding something to this regimen other than toxicity? And in this older population, so is the next step going to be NEVO-AD? You know, because as alluded to in the publication, you know, the peripheral neuropathy was still there. You know, the toxicities were still there, and mostly hematologic beyond peripheral neuropathy. But is there something innate about the disease in those individuals, or is it just age-driven?
I think that that's a great question. And my sense is that there are probably both factors going on. I mean, for example, I know a lot of my older patients have been EBV positive, you know, have EBV viral load positivity, such as the one that I just talked about. You know, that may make the disease more aggressive or different compared to some of the younger patients. I do think that the age and comorbidities is certainly a factor as well. But I do think that the biology is likely different in the older patients. And maybe that's part of the reason why the NEVO-AVD regimen worked better in these patients. I mean, of course, we're looking to see longer-term follow-up with the SWOG-S1826 results. But I think with older patients, it was very clear that they just often couldn't tolerate the BVABD. A third of patients discontinued BVABD early, and unfortunately, 10% of patients on the BVABD arm died while they were on treatment. So from my standpoint, I have enough data to go forward with this regimen already. I think we need to look more in the future about what are the biological differences and how can we really target that best. And you bring up a great point about next studies. So I think many of us are planning a larger study, the follow-up to the SWOG-S1826, in which Nivo-ABD would be the comparator arm, now becoming the standard of care. I think we're talking about different possibilities for the whole population of patients. But I think Jonathan Freeberg in particular has really led the field in this and is interested in conducting a separate older patient study. And so I agree that some of these agents may be just adding toxicity without a lot of benefit. Certainly nivolumab needs to be included, and hopefully we can go down on chemotherapy. I think I mentioned during my talk at ASH that one strategy could be to give fewer cycles of chemotherapy of NABD, for example, but can be able to continue the checkpoint inhibitor. But I agree that we could also look into taking other chemotherapy drugs out of the regimen.
Yeah, I think that historically we've really struggled as a field, right? I mean, when I educate on chemotherapy and its regimens, I try to, just like I do with past medical history of what is the most likely thing to take my patient's life, you know, I also rank list what I think is the most important drugs in the regimen. And, you know, it's hard to put, you know, Nivo just ahead of an anthracycline like doxorubicin, but it's at least a close first place. And my last two are dacarbazine and vinblastine. But it also comes down to, if you think about BVABD, you know, where BVABD was positioned in dose reductions in the, you know, the control arm, where it was positioned as kind of the fourth place drug, you know, or the first drug that ended in the dose reduce. And I'm not sure that that was the right move, but it was the move that was done with the data that we, you know, kind of had in the way the trial was. And so how do we kind of, you know, massage, is it, you know, dropping doses or dropping cycles in that regard? And I think that that's a philosophical discussion, you know, especially in advanced age Hodgkin's lymphoma, when we really talk about, you know, the history of how we got to six cycles of anything in our curative intent lymphomas. CR plus two used to be right. Dogmatic thinking, rather than removing, you know, drugs along the way, kind of like, you know, we're more of a modern raffle approach of, you know, if you get somewhere, then go. I know that interim PET wasn't necessarily, to my recollection, embedded into that. But do you think that interim PET is a value in this population too, to potentially drop drugs?
So I think we have to be cautious with PET. Unfortunately, we've all become so used to doing PET scans after two cycles, but there really are findings that we see with nivolumab and other checkpoint inhibitors that are likely not related to the response at all, and it becomes very confusing. So I think if we're going to do an interim imaging when we're using checkpoint inhibitors, we need to do CT scans. And that's what I've been doing when I use this nivolumab ABD regimen, because it's just disconcerting for patients and for us when we see this activity. But one point that Alex has made over and over again that I think has helped the trial be so successful is that even at end of treatment with PET scans in this trial, which were required, there were a number of scans that would be considered a Deauville 4. And most of the clinicians followed these patients and didn't do further treatment, didn't necessarily do biopsies, because they thought that it was likely a complete response. It just hadn't really been visualized yet. And those patients did, in most cases, convert to a CR. And the subsequent imaging was CT scan. But I think some physicians, which is my practice too, is often like, if there is a positive PET scan that's just slightly positive, I will often repeat it 2 to 3 months later. And we'll have to figure out how we're going to do that ongoing with Nivo-ABD regimen, knowing that PET scans can be positive even for months afterwards. I think that's a great question. And I think our subsequent trials are really going to need to address this type of question too.
Yeah, this is what the beauty of these type of podcasts is, to get at those clinical pearls, you know, that you've learned out of the clinical trials that you've been implementing into practice. Because I think a lot of us, you know, you get into that PET spin cycle, these Deauville 4s, and you don't want to stop doing them until you get that magical, you know, Deauville 3 or lower, you know, right, over time. But perhaps, you know, it's either that this is just some pseudo-inflammatory or an inflammatory condition that you're missing, or you just kind of say, I've done enough PETs, let's go to CT. And also, you know, I think the other clinical pearl here is yes, it has been ingrained into us, you know, over the last 5 to 10 years, really, about that PET too, you know, going all the way back to the Hasenclever data in advanced stage Hodgkin's lymphoma. I think it's great to hear that if you're considering a checkpoint inhibitor, that it may be prudent, if you want to look in the interim, to, you know, consider doing something different than a PET CT and maybe a CT, or even just these things right here, you know, which are free. For those of you, since there's no video, I was doing my jazz hands for my lymphoma physical exam that you sometimes have and can get away with by just understanding that there's chemosensitive disease that can be felt on physical exam. You know, that CT scan, you know, may be more prudent in the checkpoint kind of era in Hodgkin's lymphoma. When to utilize GCSF, Nevo, AVD, because, you know, I've been a strong kind of just push through type of person, but I think that there was some neutropenia here. And is it the same kind of ABVD, just go, or are you giving growth factor every 2 weeks in this patient population?
I'm really glad you asked that question, because I was just about to bring that up as well. And my practice is actually evolving on this, in which I'm using less growth factor. As we all know, growth factor often causes more symptoms than the chemotherapy itself, or at least as much symptoms. And I find in my practice that the younger patients and the older patients are the ones who experience the most symptoms, bone pain, et cetera, with growth factor. So I've talked to a lot of other physicians who are using these types of regimens. And honestly, my strategies have evolved in BD, AED as well, in which I'm often using Neulasta every other treatment instead of every one, or I may use short-acting growth factor rather than the full dose. I think often giving like a Neulasta Onpro with every single dose is more than necessary. I started out, when I've been using the NABD regimen in clinical practice, doing that similar approach of giving the Neulasta Onpro about every other treatment or once a cycle. But interestingly, in the SWOG 1826 study, though the neutropenia rates were higher with Nevo AVD compared to BV AVD, of course, BV AVD required growth factor and Nevo AVD did not. There was not more neutropenic fever with Nevo AVD. There was actually more with BV AVD in spite of the growth factor requirement. So I'm actually in a process of transitioning. Like, for example, my patient yesterday had an ANC of 0.9. I decided to not give him growth factor as his last treatment. I'm kind of going back more to the mentality we had in ABVD, certainly with the younger patients on the NABD regimen, but I'm going to try with the older patients to really hold off on giving it as much as possible to avoid those side effects and, again, like further improve the tolerability of that regimen.
Well, there you have it, folks. Another clinical pearl from Dr. Sarah Rutherford here, looking at not only the older population treated on the SWOG 1826, but in her practice, you know, around bone pain, which actually has been a fairly significant topic on BVABD and its utilization, but now how we grow through and grow past ABVD in advanced stage Hodgkin's lymphoma. Sarah, thank you very much for your time today, and everybody have a great day out there. And thank you for listening to Blood Club.